Hi. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Lynn Curtis. I'm co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum, and I'm also curator of exhibitions. So I am your chair for today's program. And before we begin, I just want to bring you up to date. Our next arts event is on Friday, October 19th at noon, and called What the Ink Sings to the Paper by, this is Robert Bringhurst, an author of the book The Elements of Typographic Style. Bringhurst will examine the common spirit that moves the typographer, master printer, artist, and writer. He will place particular emphasis on California printing at the center of discovery and expression in the form of printed books. So that is coming up. You can always get more information on our website. We'll have a question and answer period right after Thea's finished speaking. And I will pass around the mic, so just speak clearly because this is all being recorded. So now I'm going to give a little intro to Thea. Thea is an artist, photographer, a global marketing and management consultant, educator, mentor, and president of Global Stewards Institute. Her wide interests in archaeology, architecture, dance, the visual arts, and cultural anthropology have been drivers in her passionate quest for beauty and preserving the environment. Over the past 35 years, this passion has led her to the far corners of the world, to such places as pre-Taliban Afghanistan and India in the 70s, Buddhist monasteries in Japan in Honshu and Kyushu Islands in the 80s, and eastern Turkey in the mid-90s. More recently, she has traveled extensively through Cuba, South America, China, and Southeast Asia. It's my pleasure now to introduce Thea Bellows.
Well, thank you for coming. Okay. and it's a great honor. Lynn, thank you so much for inviting me to show my work at the Commonwealth Club and your generous present introduction. I'd also like to thank some friends who are here to join me and support me. And I want to also personally thank Peter, who's helped me hang my shows for years and being my kind of curator in waiting as well. He's a sculptor, and he's been very helpful. So I'm happy to be here today, and what I wanted to talk about was a creative odyssey. It's not just ticking off the countries that I go to. It's the impact these places have had on me and how I also bring that experience to the work that I do in the world as a professor, as a consultant, and now as an intrepid startup called the Global Stewards Institute, which we're training global leaders. And I'm heading back to Cuba in December in the Caribbean, so I'm very excited about that. So what I'm going to do today is sort of walk through some things, talk about my experiences quite a bit, but I wanted to set context about the importance of communication and the visual dialogue, not only in images but also in words. And I'm a reader of many things, and I love to read what writers write about related to photography, and whether it's Susan Sontag. But I was particularly drawn to Victor Flores Oleo's discussion about why photographers travel. And I love that he calls us creatures of the visible world, looking for stimulation, beauty, and revelation. And I would say, my mother would say the same thing. I started traveling when I was 19, and I haven't stopped. But I think it's really important, as he notes on the last line, is that we want to pierce the cultural looking glass, because that's part of the quest. And what I love about what's happening in the world now with digital cameras, everybody's walking around with a camera. I love the fact that people are becoming more visually literate. Everybody's posting their pictures on Facebook. They're making a connection. And it's changing my role as a photographer also, because everybody wants to do it and thinks they can do it, which is great to some degree, but it's a challenge. And so the world of photography and the business of photography has changed. Stock photography is done. Everybody has a Flickr account. But I think it's really fantastic what we can do in the digital world. And just even putting the show together, it gives me a challenge as an artist to be able to express what I want to, but also invite you in. I'm also looking at the whole issue of odyssey and exploration, and I was drawn, there was an artist named Carrie Smith who wrote a book called How to Be an Explorer of the World, and I've been trying to engage my students in how to become a conscious traveler, how to be aware of the environment, how to look at, not to be just a tourist going through, but you have an impact on the environment, you have an impact on the communities you go to, and it let that impact you as well. So I was drawn by his challenge to us, saying, these are some of the issues we have to look at. It's not just traveling, and it's not just exploring. There's a mixture, and everybody has a different reason for traveling. I find Americans pretty interesting that a lot of Americans don't even have passports. And I really encourage people to get out and see the world, and it's changed me considerably, and it's opened up my eyes to so many things, and I encourage people to do that. And I imagine why a lot of you are here today is because you're travelers. So I also invite you to look at the work around the walls. And I'm going to show you some of the images in the show today, but also, and I've picked out some in here, but I tried to give a mixture, and Lynn selected them, which I thought was kind of fun, a mixture of portraits, of landscape, of the spiritual world, because these are all the things that have affected me. And so Carrie has really challenged us to look, how do we use our passion? How do we document what's going on in the world? How do we observe, and how do we talk about it? Because we need to find some form of dialogue. He also expressed that we need to look closer and look at patterns and connections. And a lot of my work is very painterly, you'll see. It's not just a snap. I want to engage you in different ways to sort of see the depth and the texture. The patina and color really drives me. I have some black and white, but I'm mostly drawn to color. And I know a number of you are artists in the room who are also drawn to color as well. And this, for example, was an amazing procession I just happened to walk into in Bali when I was there a number of years ago. I also feel that my work really needs to be a statement about the challenge that we're facing in the 21st century as global stewards and citizens. Globalization's changing us, it's changing the world, and we need to really consider the impacts. And my passion is about building a multicultural world that's tolerant, peaceful, and sustainable. And this image is I was invited to photograph the Peacemakers Weekend through Camp Tawanga a number of years ago at Yosemite. It's a San Francisco-based organization. And it brought Arabs and Israelis and Americans and people from all over the world together to talk about peace. And I think it really starts, and I'm very drawn to working with young people because that's the future. And that's what I feel my role now is about, that, to bring that up. And that's what our organization is about. And I feel very strongly connected. And so we look at odyssey and exploration, so I add in the word responsibility. And I think it's extremely important. So what I've done in the rest of the show is put together a little portfolio of different places I've gone to sort of entice you in some way, encourage you to travel. I hear a number of you are getting ready for a trip. Lynn's trying to decide where she's going next. And I think it's going to the far reaches of the world that interests me, but it's not the only thing. This is the Atacama Desert, and there's a number of pictures up here about it. And it's a place that has no rain. It's a place where NASA is testing the Mars experience that just happened. They tested the robots there. And it's an amazing place that they're building a project now that's going to chart the heavens called the ALMA Project. And I was so drawn by the differences, the textures, and the images over there for a closer look. But it's an amazing place, and they invite you in. There are geysers there, and unlike America, which we'd never be able to get this close, we were walking on the geysers here. In America, they would never allow it, right? But it engages. We're at dawn, and we're wandering around, and it's people exploring every aspect of the universe, and it's a very special place, and really, it's on the border of Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia. So the people are lovely, and it's walking into events, and it sort of charms me. I'm very drawn to people and portraits, as you can tell, and there's so much movement and color and energy that you can see. We're moving into Cuba now, where I'm going to go back, and Cuba's a place in tremendous change, and when I was there, I saw it as a country in waiting, and now we're really seeing it as a country in waiting, and what I love about the images here is you really get to see a country that's gone through a tremendous amount. A lot of things have decayed. But what's really happening that's interesting is a lot has been preserved because they didn't have the money to take it out. Like in the 60s in America, we had urban renewal, and we wiped out incredible architectural stock. And in Cuba, you can still see it. And you can see on the right there, the beauty. I mean, it was a very wealthy, island, the sugar plantations and coffee plantations. And it's ready to be a booming economy at some point, but it's really remarkable. And I just loved traveling there and meeting the people. And as you can see, as everybody loves to go and look at the cars, you know, and you get a sense of the tremendous warmth and energy of the people. And, of course, you see the revolution. And I was struck that this is the 50th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs. It amazes me. In fact, in October, pay attention to Channel 9. They're going to do a program called Three Men Go to War, the story of Khrushchev, Castro, and Kennedy. And there's going to be a program. There was a film that's being made by some Irish film team. So Cuba is very much entrenched in that. They're isolated because of that. And people are really ready for change. And it's happening. And it's something that I'm very interested in because it's a tipping point. And as a traveler and as a teacher, I'm very drawn to the places where they're going to lead the next decade or the next quarter century for sure. And, of course, the people. This is the life there. And a couple of images are in the room here. And one of my favorite stories is this elderly man on the top. And some people think it's a woman because when people age, they become more androgynous. And I remember walking down the street in Santiago de Cuba, and I looked up at him, and he had this great cigar in his hand. And I looked up, and I said, okay, because I'm very respectful when I travel. If it's not right, I will not photograph. And I don't like to get in people's faces. But I like to engage the people. And I can see the young kids down here. It was definitely, I was in the middle of an amazing walking down the street, and I was totally engaged by these people. And what I love about this also is you get to see the mixture of the culture. And you definitely see it in Cuba, where you have the African and you have the European mixture, and you can definitely see that in this picture. But this is where you get met. How many people walk down the streets in San Francisco and nobody meets your eye? In places like this, they meet your eye. And that's what I love about traveling. It's why I love leaving America for exactly that reason. So moving into Argentina, anybody a tango dancer here? So everybody loves to go for tango, and I love it. And there's a Mastroianni film is on the right almost, you can see. But people are dancing out in the street. I was there right before the crash, and people were dancing. So what does that tell you? And Argentina is still living their past. I think they need to come into the 21st century. They're still living the past of the early 20th century when it was the richest country in the world with their silver mining. But when I travel, I love to read about the country. I love to read the literature. I love the history and to really get walk the back streets. And I lead a lot of trips, and I always tell my students, just get lost. Just get off the beaten track, and you can certainly do that. But you have to be safe. So this is an area called San Telmo where they're dancing, and this is La Boca, and you're not supposed to go there at night. But it's quite lovely. And one of my most incredible favorite places is the Iguazu Falls. It's on the border of Argentina and Brazil. And perhaps you've seen the movie The Mission. This is the opening stage there, and it's the most powerful falls I've ever seen. I mean, we have Niagara Falls here, and there are other ones, but Iguazu is amazing. It's a kilometer and a half of falls, and you get at it through on the Brazilian side and the Argentinian side, and it's just remarkable. And they've learned a lot from us about national parks in other parts of the world. So you really go here. There's no cars. You really get in with nature. And I just love that about Iguazu. Anybody been there? Okay, Dwight. There you go. It's the best. And Lynn was mentioned, a lot of my travels and work has been in Asia in the last decade. And I've spent a lot of time in Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam. Very drawn to what's gone on there as the economies that are changing, the emerging economies that are going to make a difference in the world. And in Thailand, where this shot is from, there's a lot of tribal people on the border of Laos, Burma, China, and Thailand. And I was very lucky to go up there, and we did a little trekking experience, and we did a homestay in a little village there. And I loved it because the village had little solar panels to be able to run their little computers, and it was really kind of fun. But it was really wonderful to see that it's still held. And it's just, they're not just dressed like this to be in the tourist thing, but these people still dress this way. This is their life, and they're beautiful people, absolutely beautiful. And, you know, there's still the connection. For me, what's important as an artist to see that the indigenous crafts and arts are still happening. and definitely you see it in throughout this whole region. There certainly want to draw the people to here through tourism and ecotourism, but it's really important that we understand the value and the impact we have on these places. Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam are all still coming back in some way from all of the challenges of the wars that occurred there, obviously. One of my favorite places in this area is Angkor Wat. It's over 400 Buddhist temples are there, and it's an amazing place. And Cambodia's gone through a lot of challenges. They still have landmines from what we call the Vietnam War. They call it the American War. It's very interesting, but it's a beautiful place. It's a sacred place, and it's a very alive place. And I really encourage, if you want to go to one place in this region, take the boat from Phnom Penh and go up to Siem Reap, and it will change you. And their connection with their past and living through it, and again the connection around their religion and their dance and their arts, which is a very strong motivator in the culture, and it's very captivating. And I really enjoyed my time there. Saigon, Vietnam. I was very drawn there. I didn't know what I was going to find. I was nervous about going because I was wondering what it would be like. And I was drawn to the fact that more than 50% of the population are under 20 years old, so they didn't even have a memory of the Vietnam-American War. And yet they're trying to do the integration with North Vietnam, and it's challenging. But the people are the hardest working people I've met anywhere. It's remarkable. And they're people that you just want to get to know. And they're taking over. China is moving. Things are moving into Vietnam from China because China is no longer the cheap labor resource. Now it's other places. So Vietnam is now the next level of the tiger economies that's going to be leading this century. And it's a very interesting place. And you also see the influence. When I travel around the world, I like to see the influence of people who occupied it as well. And Vietnam was occupied by the Chinese for 1,000 years. So these arches of Hue, it's back in the corner there, it was Chinese. And you can get to see that. But what I loved about it is the color, the patina, the connection, and the relationship to nature, which is very abiding in this culture. And it's very interesting how much of the Chinese influenced this whole area. And certainly later on, the Japanese did it as well, not in Vietnam, but certainly in other parts of China. India, it was a place for me to return to. I was there in the 70s, and I was shocked to go back in the last decade. I was there in 2008, and Chennai, which used to be called Madras, it's down in the south, is unchanged in some way, but a night train away is Bangalore, which is now the Silicon Valley of India. So India is changing a lot, and it's a country that's remarkable in so many ways. And I just love traveling in India. I love the color. I love the connection. I love that they really are really related to their past and changing it. Chennai is the Indian word. They got rid of the Brit connection. You know, now it's Mumbai, not Bombay. It's Kolkata, it's not Calcutta. And Chennai, it's no longer Madras. This is in a flower mart, and it was just amazing to go there and to be. I mean, India loves flowers, and I was totally drawn to all of the color and the people and the ceremony in some way. I mean, you can imagine. I talk about Turkey as bridging continents. I didn't know where would I put Turkey? Is it Europe? Is it Asia? It's both, right? And this is the dervishes, and I loved it because we had an opportunity to see them perform in the train station of where the Orient Express came to Istanbul. So talking about confluence of nations, this is another country that I love traveling in, wonderful people, and it's bridging continents. When I was there recently, they're really trying to up the ante to join the European Union, maybe not now given what's going on in Europe, but they really want to be a member of the Union, so they're really fixing up Istanbul. They're fixing up other parts of the world. And I learned an amazing thing, that the tulips came from Turkey. It was the flower of the Ottoman Empire. And so it really goes back, and I love their traditions, and I love the architecture, And they've done such remarkable work in looking at their buildings. For example, this looks like a church. It was a mosque before, and then it became a church, and now it's a museum. The Kariakami is up the Bosporus, and what I liked about what they're doing there is they have a connection to their past, but they don't try to make it all new. I love the fact that everything isn't filled in this restoration. And I think that's very special. And it's Byzantine, as you can see. It's just beautiful. So you see, again, the confluence of cultures, of time, of connection to different cultures. And it's a little mosque stuck in the back corners of Istanbul. And it's a place that I love to go back to. And it's a beautiful place. And again, they don't redo it all. And I think that's something to learn. In a lot of cultures, we want to make everything brand new, like Disneyland, right? And I like the fact that they're connected to their past. And again, it's something... And when we're trying to find a vocabulary for exploration and odyssey, it's something to learn about connecting to the past. It's very important. So right, your son's studying architecture. He's going to learn about that. It's important, right? And the patterns, the connections, the patinas are really very important. So, and here's something they've done. This is another little neighborhood mosque behind the Egyptian bazaar in Istanbul. And what you'll notice here are all the blue tiles. It's Izni tiles that are famous in Istanbul. Anybody been to Istanbul? It's one of my favorite, yeah, Peter has. It's one of my favorite places. If you want to go for amazing food, it's great. But they're really bringing back their mosques, and you really get a sense of the grandeur and the sounding. I mean, stand in the middle of that rotunda. It's remarkable. And what I really love about it is they're really encouraging people. You know, it's a religious place, but they're encouraging people to come in. There are a lot of cultures that don't want outsiders. And in Turkey, it's a secular country, even though it's moving a little bit more toward a religious country. But they really encourage people to see the wealth of their nation. And a lot of the wealth is, you can see it in their buildings and in their alleyways. So, yeah, so we're doing a quick trip around, and I'll answer questions afterwards. We're going to come back to Europe, and then we'll go to Africa, if you'd like. This is an amazing place, leaving Dublin, going through the Wicklow Mountains, a beautiful area. The heather was in the fall, and to go to Ireland, for me, was remarkable because of my love of music and the music of Ireland and of storytelling, because I look at photography and the work that I do as stories. That there's a way to tell stories. And I was telling Lynn when we were talking about the show that what I love the best in my studio, which is in Berkeley, is that I love when people bring their own stories to my work. The same way you did when you looked at the Recoleta Cemetery, right? Because you had an experience there. And then we all bring different experiences to the shot, to the moment. And I love that. And I think that's what photography should be about. It should be about opening the imagination, opening the storytelling and the connection. So this was a great area. And unfortunately, I was in Ireland when the pub still allowed you to smoke. I still did it. Now you can't, which is nice for me. But the music and the energy and the storytelling, it's legendary, and I totally loved it, and the people as well. Thank you. And this is an interesting story about renovation and restoration. You'll see these images here. This is from New Grange, which is a World Heritage Site. Whenever I travel, I go to World Heritage Sites. Hue was one. Angkor Wat is a World Heritage Site. They're all over the world as the way to preserve the architecture. And this is an amazing place, because if you look in here, it's an opening, a slit, during the equinox. And it's time they got the astrology all together, and all the astrological elements, and it comes up and it lights the rotunda inside, and it's a very spiritual place. But what's amazing, we've learned a lot from architecture. Look at the sod roof, right? It was hidden. This whole area, this whole mound was hidden. Some guy bought it, and suddenly he was dismantling it, and they finally said, oh my God, this is a Neolithic site. Don't do it. This is very old, but very beautiful. And look at all the rock work. And I don't know, I think in a past life I must have been an architect. I'm not sure. But I'm very drawn to it. And it's a beautiful circular building. And it was all planted. They really understood the heavens. And this is called New Grange. It's north of Dublin. And it's something I really would put on my list if you're traveling to Ireland. It's quite beautiful. And, you know, it's a craggy country, you know, and it's very much like California. You've got a lot of rocks and these rock walls that tell their own tales, as well as having a similar coastline to California. And it's, you know, they've got the fog, they've got the mood, and it's just an amazing country. As is Spain. I'm going to take you out of the cold and the fog there. Now I'll take you to the mist of the fountains in Barcelona. I was struck. I was there when I first started traveling. I was in Barcelona in 1969. And at the time, Barcelona was very inwardly facing. They had the sea, and that's where people left Barcelona to travel the Americas. But at the time, everything was geared to the inside. I returned there a few years ago, and now it's all external. When the Olympics went there, they decided they better look at their waterfront. And it totally changed the city. And it's amazing how you can twist something instead of being insular. And it was kind of a rundown area, Barcelona. And now it's the most glorious city. It's one of the most beautiful cities in Europe. If you haven't been in a while, go. And I love good food, and certainly Barcelona offers that. But it's an amazing city and quite a wonderful place to travel. And again, the architecture speaks legends of the passage of time, the connections of the Art Nouveau or Art Deco periods that exist there. And I had an amazing experience here traveling in an open, one of those two-tier buses you see traveling around San Francisco. And just to go through a city like that and just see these neighborhoods, that you can imagine what it must have been like during these times. Just an amazing place. And, of course, the people. You know, the connection with Africa, the connection to their past. I don't know where this guy came from. I don't know. It's like the tale of the jetty in some way to me, but I loved it. And I just, I happened to be there during Easter week, and that was really wonderful. And you really saw, you know, the parades and the festivities as well as the spiritual kind of connections. But it was a wonderful place, and particularly like the old gent with his beret. So the connection to Africa I mentioned with Spain, well, we go south, and now moving to, we're going to look at briefly a little bit of South Africa, which was always in my mind's eye to go. I've always been very kind of curious about South Africa, and we'll also stop in Cape Verde on the way back. But here's a city, Cape Town, that has gone through a lot, of course, and it's another place that it's another kind of place where there's a lot of change. This is a neighborhood in Cape Town where a lot of Malaysian immigrants settled called Bukap, and this is the colors. Can you imagine living around that? Can you imagine how that would change your view of the world instead of seeing all the gray, you know? And to see, because I love color, and I said, oh, my God. And I love that it's called La Rose, you know? So you see in neighborhoods popping up, and they've gone through a lot of changes, clearly, but the South Africa is leading Africa, and it's an important place, you know, not only because of the legacy of Nelson Mandela, but also that they're leading Africa in terms of moving into the 21st century and the opportunities and the challenges of a country that's moved to a democracy. And obviously it has a terrible tale from apartheid. And you'll after this you'll see some of the remnants of that. But I just kind of loved it. And, you know, it's just color everywhere, and they love animals, and there's parks and safari places, and certainly beautiful people. And that neighborhood book cap, and this is somebody hanging out, and all these different people from around the world, and certainly the children was very moved to see what world are they coming into, and what can we do as global citizens to make that passage a better world for them, because, you know, the recession's done a lot. South Africa was doing really well in 2008, hit them like it hit everyone else, and so they're making their own comeback. And we did a service project. I was with a group of students. We were taking around, and we did a little service project at this nursery. And I just love this little. It was amazing to me. It was nap time. You know, you got to keep the put. You know, it's time out. And this, I put this in here because I really feel it's important that we look at the connection of the past. This is a museum in the 6th District. This is that you've probably seen films about this. This is when they took the community, they took the Africans, the black community, and they put them into the townships because they were building a port. They put in the big port area. And so District 6 just became a big place for cruise ships and a shopping center, and these people were displaced. So they had a museum there, and you can see the connection with the Dutch and the English by the names of the streets. And it's very remarkable to see they're tracing it. But what I liked about this museum is that they'd have to tell the story. And I think if we don't tell the story and we hide it, then we repeat it. You know, we have Holocaust museums around the world for that reason. And I think an apartheid museum is a very important thing for us to look at. And they even have a bench there where it said whites only. And they had pictures of people of you have to go to different bathrooms, not unlike the American South, you know. And but what I loved about seeing this map is that you see the connection of the British and the Dutch. And I grew up in New York, and there were places on the map that was Lynbrook and Brooklyn and other places that exist in the East Coast, because we had the English and the Dutch in the East Coast as well. So I thought it was interesting. And the people there, I mean, you've got people from all over the world who settled there. I had some relatives there who a long time ago lived in Johannesburg, and I couldn't find them. But when people fled Europe, they went to places like Johannesburg and Shanghai and Buenos Aires and other places where they could go to during World War II. Very interesting place, definitely on a place that's beautiful. And what I loved about it is I was on a ship, and coming into Cape Town, where there's a confluence of three oceans, was remarkable. And I've never thought I'd like to be on a ship traveling, but I fell in love with it, because your experience of coming into a country by sea is a totally different experience. And I really loved it, totally. And we wrapped up our journey with the students. We stopped in Cape Verde on our way back. And this is the Portuguese. It was one of the first places the Portuguese traveled around West Africa to go to India. And so they speak Portuguese there, and you see the color and the textures and the buildings. That it could be Lisbon. And it's a poor area, but they've got the best music in the world. How many people have heard of Cesária Vora? Yeah, she's, you know, and we actually got to see her house. Our little guy who was taking us around, when he was a kid, he used to bring water to her. So we went by her house. It was kind of wonderful. And she's remarkable, beautiful music. And, again, it was just a very amazing place. And, again, the mixture of people. And you see what I love when I travel, to see the hybrid. I don't know how many of you are hybrid, but I am. And when people come from different countries, this the most amazing thing happens, what you look like, and you can certainly see it in the faces here. And I was very drawn to the faces and the people and their life. And they have a hard life there, for sure. They're desert islands. They're desert, you know, basically, and they only have their beaches, and it's a very hard life in a lot of these countries. But they do it, and you can definitely see their own connection to their colonial past and a little bit of Carnival as well. And the Portuguese connections. So in closing, I mean, we've talked about exploration, we've talked about discovery and the Odyssey, and I couldn't help but put in T.S. Eliot's passage from the Four Quartets. We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And I think we all have to consider that we're traveling wherever we are, even if you're just in San Francisco, if you can remember that we're travelers, right? And remember that, you know, take the earbuds out, pay attention to what's going on around you, and you meet remarkable people and see amazing things. And I don't know, I feel part of my role as a teacher and an artist is to really go out and see the world and bring the world to our doorsteps as well. So I'd love to answer any questions you have. It's a little brief snap of what I'm trying to do and bring my worlds together as an educator, a photographer, and as a business person, because I'm a teacher as well, so it's a whole mixture, and I love and I teach mostly international students, so that's part of why I'm committed to this kind of work. So thank you, and Lynn, thank you again.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'll leave it on that. That's the trail.
Thank you. That was terrific. Thank you, Thea. Don't wander away. Okay. So we're going to open it up for questions. But that was terrific. Terrific. So, okay, I have a microphone here. We ask that you speak in the microphone because we're recording this program. Okay. Does anyone have any questions? Which I'm probably scaring you all with this microphone.
No? You want to ask a question then?
Oh, here we go.
Okay, we got some. Good.
Would you talk more about the Global Stewards Institute?
Thank you for asking. yeah, this is an organization that I started with a group of people. We were traveling together on the ship that I mentioned, And it was called the scholarship. And I traveled with 150 students from 30 countries. Blew my mind. And talking about multicultural connections and turned on, switched on, transformational experience, I said, wow, this is what I want to do next. And unfortunately, it was started by the Royal Caribbean cruise lines, and they did it as an educational tourism thing. And we realized this is not. This has got to be a nonprofit. This has got to be about passion. And I was really convinced from this experience that we really need we need to create opportunities for young people to step into their leadership. And I feel that that's part of my role as an artist and an educator. And I never laughed so much in my life. I danced every night, and I saw something that was really important. And I got to see what people did, how they were impacted by one another, how, you know, when you put people together in this cauldron, things happen. They happen creatively. They happen dynamically. People learn about conflict and how to resolve conflict. So the program, it happened in 2008. It fell apart because of the recession and the cost of fuel and the cost of food. So a number of the students came to me and said, we don't want this to die. So I said, okay, well, what are you going to do here? So we created an opportunity to create like a student alumni association, and out of that grew this amazing program, which we were given an opportunity to develop a curriculum, and we are now launching our program. After 3 years, we've become a nonprofit. I have some material if you would like to see it. And we have UC Riverside as our educational partner. It's going to be a postgraduate program in global leadership. And because we really want people to be engaged, and it'll bring them together academically. It's postgraduate, so either you've graduated, you know, university, or you're in your senior year, or you're in a master's program, you can transfer credit. And we are launching this program to Panama, Cuba, and the Caribbean in December. So I kind of feel like my fingers are always crossed. My friends can tell you this has been, my passion about really making this happen. So we all came together. We've got leaders from all over the world on our advisory group, and who really see the value of this. And it's experiential, totally experiential. We're going to get out there. We're going to travel together. We're going to be on a ship for 7 days. We're going to do some land work. And we're staying at the City of Knowledge in Panama. Panama is going to be one of our hubs. And the City of Knowledge is the old Fort Taylor where the Americans were. It's across the street from the Panama Canal. And so that's where we're launching our program. And it's we have students from all over the world, and professors and guest scholars from all over the world participating with us. So, it's been a lot of hard work, and it's not over. And Peter has actually helped me a lot on the financials. we're all trying to put this thing together. It's totally a labor of love, but I feel myself that that's really what the future is about. We have to support the young people, and I think you were mentioning, you got young people, you're raising kids, right? And you want to launch them in a way that they can see the world. And it's not just going to a campus and living in a dorm or doing a homestay. It's this melting pot that's important. So that's what we're working on. And I can give you some more material on it. We have a website and doing everything else. And I might even put this slideshow on it. And we've got a Facebook page. So I'm learning a lot from my students. Thank you for asking.
Anyone else?
When you travel for photographic purposes, do you tend to travel by yourself and just sort of go places that you think will be interesting to you? Or like you mentioned, you were on a cruise, or you mentioned you took a boat ride to Angkor Wat. I guess what I'm asking is, in your experience, do you get more when you're like really just going out there or traveling with a group? And a second part to that is, do you feel like you get some of your best photographs when you're just randomly meeting someone or living your life as opposed to looking for them?
Well, that's how I shoot. I don't go with a plan. I don't sit at a site for an hour waiting for that perfect moment, though I'm more of inclined. My eye was trained by seeing photography and traveling.
Cartier-Bresson, the decisive moment was something that informed the way I looked. And I loved what he did. He just walked around and he just took out his camera and he was shooting, right? I've been a traveler since I've been 19. Some of it's with, you know, a friend or two, a lot of times by myself. Because I just like to get lost. As I said, I tell my students to get lost. I like to get lost also. I walk down back alleys. I try to be careful with my equipment. I usually have it covered with a scarf or something. But, you know, it's difficult. And if I'm in a group, you don't get the same experience. People see you differently. I think it's better for me to go if you can. But I think the world is a scary place. When I started traveling when I was 19, it was a very different experience than it is now. You know, and you have to be mindful of that. But, you know, I just think it's, you know, I like to have my camera with me, and actually I do a lot more shooting when I'm traveling than I do in my day-to-day life, because it just gives me that excuse, and I get lost in my own mind by shooting, I mean, as my creative experience. Are you a photographer? Okay, there you go. Yeah. Oh, it's my evil twin. I'm the evil twin. No, but is that your experience? I mean, just being solo and traveling and seeing that, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to Angkor, and I had an hour-long conversation with a monk who wanted to practice English, and I think I eventually took his picture. For me, it's just like living in, I know that for me personally, I've asked friends this, I like look at something and I see a picture, and you ask 10 random people, do you see that? Do you just like frame it with your mind before you do it? And they don't. So that's a gift from wherever. Mm-hmm. And so you're just walking around and you take that picture. I haven't done anything with them except show my friends, and that's okay with me.
That's the beginning. Yeah.
But I've loved exploring, and I personally find I have much more interesting interactions both photographically and personally with people when you're by yourself or with one other person.
It's daunting otherwise, but I think it's interesting to sort of see, like if I'm with a group, what I do is I sort of step back a little bit, I let them go, or I get up really early in the morning and I just go out. And when I was at Angkor Wat, I was by myself, and it was great. I met this guy who actually was a driver, and he said, I'm going to take you to the good places. And sort of going to people and just sort of saying, because, you know, light is important to me. I like to shoot early in the morning, late afternoon. And it's in knowing an area and finding it. But a lot of times I just stumble into things, or I might know. But I don't try to be as deliberate, because I think the experience is having the experience and seeing where you're going to wander into. And you have to be safe. Obviously, as a woman, you have to be safe and be careful about it. And if you're walking around with camera gear, you know, I mean, I'm aware of that as well. But I think there's something, my interaction with the environment's important, and how I frame things. I mean, I see things that people don't see. That's my gift, you know, and I love that. And what I love is when I come back and I said, oh, that's interesting how that came out. The opening shot of the show was a bicycle. It was on a roof. And it was funny because I was experimenting with some new film. Shot with film. And that was actually black and white film that's produced on color. And I, by mistake, put that in my camera when it was totally a color field. And when I first got it back, I said, oh, no. And then I loved it because I hadn't shot black and white in years. And the richness of the black and white, it was perfect because you got to see something very different. And doing all that and seeing what the connections are with people. And when that was shot in Valparaiso. And what I love is I had a show at La Peña in Berkeley where a lot of Chilean expats live. And there's a cafe next door called Cafe Valparaiso, and he loved the show. I did a show there. I did all the black and white pictures, and he and I took a shot from the exact same place of where he lived, the street he lived on. So what happens is it's magic, right? And you don't get that when you're around a lot of people. But I think it's important to travel. I think it's important to get out of there and lose our connection to where we are and let other things happen. I met the most amazing people when I traveled, and I was open in a different way. And I love those words I get in the beginning of just, you know, alter, you know, just change. You know, the images of you know, the words. I mean, if we all can live by changing our view of some of these expressions, right? Well, come on. You know? if we look at that, what if we lived our lives just by some of these words, right? Because how many times do we not observe? We're just moving ahead, right? Got to go to the next thing. So traveling changes you, and it slows me down, which is a miracle.
There was a, I'll say it's a paraphrase, but it might still be a quote that I read years ago from Lonely Planet telling mm-hmm. people to travel. And it said something like, if you want to do something for your country, leave.
Right. Absolutely.
Which they didn't mean meanly. They meant go travel.
No, absolutely. And not only that, I'm teaching at Holt International Business School right now, and I was just at a ceremony the other day. They were students from 99 countries. 600 students from 99 countries. And suddenly, so they had a calling. At the UN, they do this. They'll call the nations, and people stand from where they're from. So they did that. They had a ceremony, and they called out the nations, and people were asked to stand. And it was probably the first time in their life they were like an ambassador from their country. And when I was living on the ship with these students, it was the same thing. We asked them to identify culturally who they were, not only where you came from, but who you connected with. And so we had students who were doing Bollywood dances who came from Norway. We had students from Spain suddenly doing, you know, the gumshoe dance from South Africa. So they really got caught out of their own comfort zone, which is important. That's what happens. You know, you got to get out of your comfort zone, and traveling puts you in the moment. It really absolutely puts you in the moment, and it's a responsibility with that too. And I think Lonely Planet was right. I mean, they changed how we travel, too, in good ways and bad ways, because now everybody uses the Lonely Planet book, and everyone goes to the same restaurant, the same pension, right? So you got to work around that somewhat. But I think they were great. You know, they wrote the book that I wanted to write in the 60s. So, but I was starting to travel then. But I think I think it's great. We need to get out and see the world, absolutely. And now every government and every university is requiring students to have an international experience. But I want to give them something different instead of just going to a dorm or living in one country. I think that mixing and that creative tension that happens when people are forced to be learning together and traveling together and experiencing together is essential. So where are you going next?
Nowhere. I have one more totally different.
Sure.
Do you miss film?
Yeah.
Why?
I think it's better. What I love about digital, just start with that, is that you can shoot like crazy and not get crazy, right? When I film, I'd be traveling with 50 rolls of film, right? And I go, ooh, do I really, I have so many more weeks, I don't know, am I going to run out of film, right? I think digital's getting better. I think it's advanced a lot. I shoot with a full format digital camera now. And I'm forced to because of publications, printing, you can do it more easily now. I mean, it's still, film is flipped. It's now more expensive, but I love the depth and the color of film. I don't manipulate my pictures. A lot of people who work in digital do. And I think we got to be careful of that. I was at a lab and beautiful pictures of Antarctica. And the guy told me, oh, you see that moon? We just put that in there. The guy wanted a moon in it. And I feel that's corruptive, right? I don't think you can't corrupt in the same way. But, digital is dodging and burning. I mean, you do that. You can do that in Photoshop. I'm not that adept. I think I use it as a tool. I'm not the most technically savvy person. I'm learning. But some people can do it. They can build a whole picture, pixel by pixel. It would make me mad, but people do it. But I still have film in my refrigerator. I haven't gotten rid of my film camera yet. But it was interesting. I mean, that you can do a lot and you can dispose of it and move on, but it's also forced me to carry a lot more equipment with me. I need my computer. I need a hard drive. I've got to upload it. I'm leaving in a couple of months now, and I go, oh my God, how am I going to do all this? So it puts me into a different way of staying connected. But I don't know. How do we move on and use what we can as best as we can? So I'm not going to give it up yet. I haven't used. I still have a lot of film. You want some film? So anyway, good question. Yeah, thank you.
Do you use more than one type of camera? Do you have like a small one and a large one for different types of shots?
When I'm setting up a shot, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, just when you're walking around.
Oh, yeah, I have a walk-around camera. You know, I use, I've been a Canon devotee for a long time, so I stick with it, you know, because my lenses are, you know, I can use them in all the different cameras. And I have a little point-and-shoot also, if I want to have that. And, you know, the cameras are getting better and better and better now. And now the small cameras, you could shoot raw. I shoot raw so you can work with it. You know, JPEGs are issues with, you know, not to get into too much technical stuff. But, yeah, I mean, I think the little cameras are great. And now there's amazing cameras. You can do video. And I have an SLR, full frame that I mentioned. It's like an antique now because it's changing so fast. And now the camera can now do, you know, videos, high-end HD videos, the camera. So are you looking into getting a camera? Are you trying to figure it out? Yeah.
Trying to figure it out.
Yeah. It's a lot to take, you know. You know. Welcome. It's a lot to consider when you take a camera. I mean, you know, if you want to just have fun and not worry about, you know, this investment you're taking around with you, you can buy a really nice camera for under $1,000, a small one, or even under $500, you know. I'd be happy to talk to you about some of it, but I use Canon, Nikon has good stuff. There's a lot of really good cameras out there. But I think you have to be mindful of what you're doing, and again, that you take an extra battery, take extra CD cards or SD cards, whatever. But it gives you a lot of flexibility, and you can get rid of it, and you can upload it and keep your friends attuned to what you're doing if you're traveling. So it's fun. Like I said, what I love about it is that people are shooting. Putting a digital camera in someone's hand, it says, go for it. Be creative. Have a good time. You know? And I think that's great. I really encourage people to be as creative as possible. So, yeah. Where are you going?
Israel, soon.
Ah, beautiful pictures. Yeah. Good. Have a wonderful time. Yes.
Thank you. Firstly, I want to encourage the woman to my left to not think that she is just storing these photographs away for friends and comfort. You never know what will occur in the years to come. And after, say, 10, 20, 30 years, which has just happened to me, someone could become interested in a work that you have done at that time, and suddenly it becomes famous. Excuse me. The next thing I wanted to say to you is your interest in color in the various nations that you have traveled. As a color theorist, I'm interested in this subject. Mm-hmm. How do you receive the information from the natives of a country in highly colorful clothes compared to the natives of a country such as my two heritage, Ireland and Germany, okay, where there is no color at all? We wear heather tweeds, gray, forest green. How do you attribute the culture influence with the differences in color that the natives wear? It's like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did color influence the natives, or did the climate influence the color? And how do you think that psychologically affects the natives?
Well, I think it's interesting. I have a great story about that. I was in Afghanistan, pre-Taliban Afghanistan, as you mentioned, and talking about having pictures that I had stored away. I have pictures of the Bamiyan Buddhas that are now gone. And I put them on display, and people were blown away because I have a history there. And so it is important to sort of have the record. And in fact, a student of mine who ended up becoming the ambassador to America from Afghanistan, they fled there, and he never saw Bamiyan. You know, didn't see the Buddhas, and he didn't see his own country. And I was able to record something, and it was remarkable, you know, for him to see that, because they fled when they were younger. And I mean, I feel very privileged to do the travel that I've done. But I've given up a lot to do it because I really value that experience. But going back to Afghanistan, what I loved about it, it's a desert country, high mountain desert. And you know what people, what color people wanted to wear there? Green. They had such a draw to the green. They also had another tremendous thing. Perhaps you've seen the trucks from Afghanistan. They have panels, beautiful colors, wild colors. They have science fiction missiles and planes on these trucks. They were trying to bring the world to them. It was amazing. And you see, I mean, you might have seen these panel trucks. So I think in some, in the void, people fill in. I think also we have camouflage. I think people also dress to fit into a climate because you need to for your survival. You know, in Afghanistan, you see it's tribal, so you see they have incredible turbans. I mean, I learned how to do that. I love their turbans. I mean, I love scarves, you could tell. But that's all the color and the texture is all related to their tribes. So there's color connections to that, which I thought was, you know, that's a very important indicator, right? I think in Northern Europe, you know, you think about where people came from. They bring that with them. The same way they bring their architecture. Think about the Europeans who've come to America. Look across the country. Look at the architecture of the barns. You can tell where they came from. They were from Germany. They're from Sweden. You can tell by the design of that. And I think people sort of fit in. You know, it's boring, I think, a lot in Northern Europe, right? But color makes sense in some countries. It doesn't make in others. Like I remember traveling in Mexico and New Mexico, and I said, yeah, this color makes sense here. It doesn't make sense where I live, but it makes sense here, right? And I live in Berkeley now, and it's really a riot when people try to paint their houses and because they spent some time in some place. And like, you know, I don't think so. Well, the neighbors freak out. Why are you painting a color that bright orange, you know? But I think color tells you a lot. It telegraphs a lot. People dress for the heat. People dress for protection. The skin tones, you know, in India are amazing. And I just read an article in the New York Times the other day. This Indian woman is going back. She was in Wall Street. She was an investment banker. And is going back to India to help people like herself transition back to her country and really, you know, use the fabric and the color from India because it looks beautiful on them. You know, the same way, I mean, you know, Westerners wearing a sari doesn't make it. It makes total sense for an Indian woman to wear a sari. You know, because of the shape of their bodies, their skin tones, the connection of wearing a garment you can wear your whole life. The same way with kimono, right? I think that we, you know, in the West, you know, have given up a lot on color, and I think we want to regain that. I love color. I'm very drawn to it. And it makes sense in certain countries. But even in Ireland, there's a kind of calmness when you see the mood of the gray and the green, right? You know? I don't know. What do you think in Germany? Do you think it's, you know, why are all that, you know, it's very drab, isn't it? A lot
well,
of the color.
Well, actually, this is what I'm working on in my work at this time, is how does color influence humanity? I believe that color in itself is a communication.
Oh, totally, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, look at this picture from Bali.
Right.
I mean, it's movement, it's color.
Origin of this photograph and those people, the color that they chose was green.
Mm-hmm.
Well, green happens to be absolutely documented to be the color that is the most soothing that we have as humans.
Right.
So it makes sense that those people in this stark reality would choose that.
Right.
So, thank you. I just am very.
But there's one other thing, just cross-culturally, you know, I teach international marketing, as I mentioned. People make mistakes all the time by the use and misuse of color. Because in the West, white is used at weddings. It's a joyful, virgin kind of thing. In the East, it's death. So in India, you get married in red. In the West, we think red. Ah, red. We know what that means, right? So it's a cultural thing. There's a lot of indicators that go along with it. I'm fascinated by it. And there's a lot of really good color theorists out there. And I'm drawn to understanding why the combination of colors exist and why people do what they do. But a lot of the tones, I mean, if you go back to earth tones, because they didn't have the acrylics, you know. Even rugs, the whole aniline dyes changed rug making because suddenly you can have these colors that didn't have the same experience. You know, if you go to Turkey and you go to rug places, you see the difference. And they brought in aniline dyes a long time ago, you know, but the vegetable dyes are still beautiful and they last longer, you know, there's a reason for that. But I'm glad you brought that up. I love color, absolutely. Anything else?
I'm afraid we have to bring this to a close. But we'll officially end it, but you can stay and have some questions answered.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming, and great questions. And I really just want to remark to you, I hid my work for a long time. And then I said, you know what, I'm bringing it out. And I created a little gallery for myself. I started selling my work, and I changed my life by bringing my creative work into the rest of my other work. So I really encourage you to do that. So it was a good reminder. So I'm sure you must have some great images. Thank you.